Welcome to Fortress on a Hill. I'm Henry.
I'm Danny.
I'm Kagan.
We're three leftist veterans that aim to expose the reality of the U.S. military's multiple wars abroad and to illuminate the damage military service does to Americans.
American presidents throughout U.S. history have used American military and diplomatic power to force regime change of democratically elected governments around the world.
Most veterans come from families vested in prior service, and American generals choose their own, ensuring diversity of thought never interferes with American warmongering.
How can we stand by and do nothing while our military kills and destroys lives the world over, while telling Americans that all this death and destruction protects them from terrorists, when nothing could be more false?
Fortress on a Hill aims to change that. You
good people. All right, listeners. We are back with another episode and another interview and a string of great interviews here on Fortress on a Hill. The pandemic edition ongoing, the post-Biden victory, all is well, that isn't actually well edition. And every time that I've been introducing the show, I've been talking about how our guest list has just been better and better. And we've had a heck of a run, I mean, this last year with guests. And actually, you know, Roxanne was one of our earlier guests when things really started getting strong, you know, when we started getting some really prominent authors and activists and veteran figures. And so we had talked when Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz was on our show months back that we would have her again, because it was one of those great episodes where we felt like we didn't cover anything despite covering everything, because it was such a good conversation. And so we're lucky to have her back on today. But I'll just give a much briefer than usual kind of bio on Roxanne for those people who didn't hear the last episode or are not familiar with her work. But she is a historian, author, memoirist, speaker, longtime activist in just a number of different areas and issues, and an incredible backstory that we talked a lot about in the last episode. So go back and check it out. She researches Western Hemisphere history, international human rights, and of course, Native American history. She grew up in rural Oklahoma. She's the daughter of a tenant farmer and a part Indian mother. She's been active in the international indigenous movement, okay, not just here in the United States, for more than four decades, known for her lifelong commitment, you know, to social justice issues, international and national. She got her PhD at the University of California, Los Angeles, down at UCLA. She taught in the newly established Native American Studies program at Cal State, Hayward, and helped found the departments of Ethnic Studies and Women's Studies. You know, her 1977 book, The Great Sioux Nation, was kind of the fundamental document at the first International Conference on Indigenous Peoples of the Americas, which was held at UN headquarters, okay, in Geneva. And she is the author and editor of several other books since then, including Roots of Resistance, which is a history of land tenure in New Mexico. Two of her more recent works were the very prominent Indigenous Peoples History of the United States, and then Loaded, a disarming history of the Second Amendment. And now she's, you know, got a forthcoming book, Not a Nation of Immigrants, Settler Colonialism, White Supremacy, and a History of Erasure and Exclusion. I mean, wow, what a hard-hitting subtitle and right up my alley. But, you know, I think that all of these, especially recent books, are particularly relevant for this, like, peculiar kind of tragic moment of ours. And that doesn't really do her extensive work justice, but we're going to dig into all kinds of things. And so, yeah, Roxanne, thanks for coming on again.
Thanks so much, Danny. It's good to listen to the podcast. I it's hard to keep up with them while I was writing the book, but I have a lot to go back to and listen to. And thank you for interviewing me again.
Oh, well, it's always a pleasure. And, you know, I remember the last time when you came on, we talked about how you had sent us an email and said that you were a fan of the show. And we were pretty, like, excited by that, the fact that you were even listening at all. So that's a pretty cool thing, you know, when you find out that. I think I'm still surprised that anybody cares what I have to say, and I'm sure Henry feels the same way. But to kind of open it up a bit, you know, you've got the book forthcoming, and we'll dig into to all of that. But I'm sure this, you know, kind of opening question of mine will relate. But, you know, we talked leading up to the episode, you know, earlier today when we were kind of working out what we would talk about empire, sort of, about imperialism. One of the things that's been interesting to me is it's something that I have written about a good deal. Empire is one of the frameworks in my forthcoming, you know, U.S. history book that came from the Truth Dig series. And I even minored in like imperial history in grad school, specifically British, but I covered other things. One of the things that struck me is that at least in the scholarly world, but more and more to some extent in like the public history and also public policy world, terms like empire, terms like imperial are starting to get at least a little bit more of a hearing as it relates to describing the United States. And that was not very possible even 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 15 years ago. You just didn't hear it very often in the public space, at least. Scholarship was ahead of it on that. But I'm interested in how you know, I know your book kind of ties to this, and even just the subtitle makes it clear. But first part is, you know, how do you kind of view the empire issue, the imperialism issue, the colonialism issue as it relates to our self-styled sort of republic? And also, as a follow-on, does the word empire, does the word imperialism tend to be read or viewed differently from various marginalized communities or historically marginalized communities in the United States, whether it be Native Americans or African Americans?
Yeah, it is getting more common to refer to U.S. as an imperialist state. But, you know, this is fairly recent. It was really with the George W. Bush administration and the invasion of Iraq that regular U.S. historians started saying, maybe this is imperialism, you know, but treading very softly. I remember writing an essay for Monthly Review. Well, they did, you know, actually a whole book on U.S. imperialism, and that it was a cutting edge, you know. This was like 2001, 2002. So what they've always done, U.S. historians, is lock a period of U.S. imperialism, 1898, and that only goes really through, they only take it through the 1830s, if that even, you know, when the U.S. was occupying Nicaragua and Haiti and the Dominican Republic, and had, of course, had colonies. So that was, if you did U.S. history in high school or college, undergraduate, that's a chapter of in history, not the U.S. history, but a chapter that came and went. So they were really asking in 2001, has it come back? You know, they weren't really conceding that the U.S. was founded as an imperialist state. But I decided to be a historian, it was based on a class I took at San Francisco State as an undergraduate that made me decide to major in history, that was called imperialism. And it was called world history, actually, but the text we used was called Imperialism, written by an author named P.T. Moon, M-O-O-N, Moon, in the 1930s. It's a brilliant book. I still have a copy of it. It was just an eye-opener because, you know, it talks about U.S. imperialism as an imperialist state and explains what it is. So this was my entry into history, and that was the last class, the first and the last class I had throughout my undergraduate, you know, graduating in history of that you know, I bring it up in classes and everyone would roll their eyes. You know, what are you talking about? U.S. imperialism. So then in graduate school, the first year I did a Latin American history seminar, my first year I was, because I wanted to do the Southwest, and so you had to do Latin America and the United States. And there they just threw around, you know, perfectly conservative professors and students throwing around the term U.S. imperialism because they're dealing with Latin America. So then I take the U.S. seminar the next year, and they're talking about manifest destiny. You know, the invasion of Mexico is manifest destiny. And I had never heard that term before, or I hadn't, you know, I hadn't absorbed it. And I wouldn't have thought of it as, you know, a term to replace imperialism. So I held up my hand and I said, are you talking about imperialism? And the professor actually said to me, are you a Marxist? So that was, you know, that's my experience with dealing with imperialism. I wasn't exactly a Marxist yet, but I thought, well, that's something I should read. I guess someone agrees with me. But I don't think Marx really understood the United States either and didn't deal with U.S. imperialism. But I think the main thing had people had, you know, throw the term around. It means many different things. They refer to, you know, there are two books called The Comanche Empire. And I'm thinking, where was the capital of that empire? Yeah. What was that about? But it's a best-selling book, you know, and now the same author who's from Finland, wrote one on the Lakota Empire, you know. Don't know where that capital was either, but it does get, you know, it does get thrown around. But I think it has to be attached to capitalism in the last 500 years to make any sense. I mean, it had its predecessors, you know, in the Roman Empire, and then of course the Holy Roman Empire, far more imperialist than the. They're the ones who sent Columbus out, you know, much more imperialist than the previous Roman Empire. But the United States became an empire as a settler, as a settler colonialism, the first settler colonial state based on capitalism. The British had colonized Ireland and settler colonialism, but it was, and that was the precursor to, of course, their other imperialism. But Ireland wasn't then made in, you know, in itself, it was colony. Whereas the United States, the colonies were not really colonies. They were, you know, it's a misnomer really to talk about the British colonies in North America. They were extensions of the British Empire. They were British people, you know, they were not colonized by the British. They were the British colonizers. So they were colonizing the native peoples. And of course, Africans, enslaving Africans. So, you know, that's unfortunately much of the world, including national liberation movements, including Frantz Fanon and others, believe the narrative of the United States. And Frantz Fanon ends his, you know, that book is like a Bible to me, or like a Bible is to Christians. But he ends it with this plea to the decolonization movements in Africa, taking the U.S. as an example of a country founded in revolution that went off the tracks, you know, and that is so disappointing that Hanan could not have conceived. You know, that's why we're in such a mess. You know, not only do the citizens of the United States not, and anyone who's political, including most people on the left, not deal with the real U.S. history, but the whole world has this image of a struggling little colonies of Britain rebelling and creating this beautiful, perfect democracy that went off the tracks, you know, in this way or that way. But it was really a split in the empire. It was sort of like the Civil War. No one would call the Confederacy a colony that split off. It was a split in the U.S. Empire, because the Confederates were just as imperialist as the Union. They wanted to make states out of Nicaragua and Honduras. Make U.S. states out of them. We're already sending before and during the Civil War actually trying to create settlements there. So they were imperialist too. So that was a split in an empire, just as the United States split from Britain. Once they won, they canceled all their debts. They were in debt to merchants, huge, huge debts they all held. They had to win or else they were bankrupt as individuals. But they had personal wealth, but they didn't have, a resource base for capitalism. But they had the conception of capitalism, and that is embedded into the Constitution itself. So the commodity, capitalism requires commodification of goods, of all goods, and making it into a saleable unit. So the only immediate resource they had to commodify, to create wealth, state wealth, not just individual wealth, was land. And that land, of course, belonged to the native people. And so the Northwest Ordinance, the land ordinance they devised in 1787, right before the Constitution was based on it. The land ordinance is the most important document in U.S. history that hardly ever gets taught. It's the outline for taking the continent. It's the maps even to the Pacific. And, of course, half of Mexico, actually, I think almost all of Mexico is included in those maps as a destination. And so this is, you know, this is what has been called a fiscal military state, that a capitalist state built for war, because this was going to take war. They knew that because they had already been 160 years warring. It took 160 years to take the 13 colonies, which were just on the edge of the Atlantic Ocean. So to take the whole continent, it was 100 years war. I call it the 100 years war. And that's what it should be in U.S. History texts, that was many wars or many battles in many different nations they were fighting and annexing. But in all of that, it was land. And then the second important land legislation was during the Civil War under Lincoln, the Homestead Acts and the Desert Land Acts, all of the acts that created for the West that was not yet conquered at all, west of the Mississippi, except for the former Spanish colonies. And even there, they hadn't conquered the native people who were resisting the Apaches and the Navajos and the Comanches. Those wars would go on, but they were already mapping that land and distributing it both to companies and to individuals, the railroads, so forth. So real estate then, and is still the basis of U.S. capitalism, which is unusual in the world. I mean, nowhere else in the world is the capitalist economy grounded in real estate. In 2008, that depression that was devastating was the collapse of the real estate market that affected everything. So this is then, you know, really what imperialism is the grabbing of resources. And if they have to colonize the people, I think, you know, they prefer not to if they don't have to. The British had developed intermediaries, the Raj, mostly to rule for them. And that was much more profitable than, you know, trying to run a colony. But the United States created settler colonialism as a way of building, you know, the capitalist state and the military power to then move overseas. But we have to remember that it wasn't just continental, that the United States was in North Africa. That's where the Marines got their hymn, the halls of Montezuma to the shores of Tripoli. So Tripoli, I don't know why it doesn't ring with people as what were U.S. warships doing in two wars against the Berbers in North Africa. And it was opening up trade because they were charging them fees to go into their ports. It took two wars to end those fees. So the United States was already, you know, that was Thomas Jefferson's administration, 1806 and 1808. So that's my, you know, my sort of, excuse me, I thought I had turned my phone on. That's my short course on imperialism.
Sure. Well, as one quick follow on before I let the other guys get a word in edgewise, which is never my strength. I'm interested in so much of what you said, and I've got sort of my own take on it that I think is, you know, it's in line with a lot of scholars and pretty similar to what you're mentioning here. And I think it's so important the way we phrase the empire thing. You know, as a side, it's funny that they asked you if you were a Marxist, because it seems like I get asked that question every time I say anything about human decency or justice. Like, people are like, whoa, what you just said sounds like something Jesus would say. Are you a communist? You know, so that's like a fascinating aside. But I think that what's interesting, two things jumped at me that you said. One was that, you know, even certain like foreign liberation movements, you know, international figures that are, you know, otherwise, you know, on the side of justice and rebellion against, you know, injustice, often don't really understand the United States, including Marx to a certain extent, as you mentioned. And it does seem to me that not just the American citizenry, but to some extent, although it's changing, but to some extent for a long time, the international community also fell for the myth of America. And so much of what you're describing is sort of deflating much of that myth. And one of the second thing that really jumped out at me, I think is important, I'd like to hear a little bit more on from you is you mentioned that what I've called, so when people teach American history, the only era that they are even willing to think of calling it American Empire is, like you said, from about 1898 with the Spanish-American War, when we kind of jump overseas to, you know, take these Spanish Caribbean and Pacific colonies, really from about there to, like you said, at most the 1930s, when we have Marines all over the Caribbean and Central America. And I've called it the imperial blip teaching, that it's taught as though America had this little blip in its history where it like dabbled in empire a little, but that was a mistake. That was an anomaly. When in reality, as I often argue, and I think you largely agree, you know, the United States is sort of an imperial entity from the start, even as colonies, a settler colonial enterprise. And I gave a lecture, like a guest lecture yesterday on, or on Wednesday, on the Mexican-American War for a libertarian outfit. I'm big on the libertarian circuit for some reason. And I was describing this, the different phases, and talking about how, well, you know, one of the first real regime change wars in American history, that phrase is big now, right? One of the first regime change wars was against another republic, right? Our neighbor in Mexico. And it's interesting because it's that war which creates From Sea to Shining Sea. You know, in other words, that's not who we really are quite yet until we take a third or more of the northern part of Mexico. And it's clear from looking at the documents from his administration and the comments in the Democratic Party hack newspapers that the Mexican-American War wasn't ever really about Texas. The real prize for Polk, the president, and for the Democratic Party stalwarts in general was California. They say it like it's really about California, like getting the Pacific. And of course, you probably don't have the Philippine invasion, occupation, the imperial blip, so to speak, that mythology. That doesn't happen unless we become a Pacific power. And we become a Pacific power because of that first phase of empire, either seizing land from Mexico or colonizing and displacing and murdering Native American peoples. And of course, also sort of colonizing and creating second-class citizenship for the Mexican peoples of the Southwest. So I'd be interested if you could, you know, kind of talk about why you think that imperial blip, as I'm describing it, if you agree, why that's a problematic way of teaching it. And then that first phase of empire surrounding the Mexican component.
Yeah, that, you know, getting to California, which was, of course, 1887, the Northwest Ordinance was definitely, they had to get to the Pacific, and the Spanish Empire was in a way. So Thomas Jefferson also sent out Pike, a Zebulon Pike, army officer, spy, to accidentally get arrested by Spanish officials. Mexico was not yet liberated. They were just beginning their national liberation movement that didn't succeed until 1821, a really brutal 10-year war. But Pike was taken all the way to Mexico City from that area called Pike's Peak, where he was detained. And he was a map maker. He was a spy. So imagine, he had this whole trip. It took a month, you know, to get there to Mexico City to be interrogated. And he was mapping the whole way. And that was later the path, you know, that the first, the Northern invasion took place. There was an invasion by sea, of course, the Veracruz. But what, you know, Walter Johnson, the historian at Harvard, Walter Johnson's new book on St. Louis, is really important reading, because St. Louis was the outpost for imperialism very, very quickly by the 1830s. And there, you know, Thomas Hart Benton and his son-in-law, John Fremont, these people who were urging, you know, getting to the Pacific, they were obsessed with China. Getting to China. And when I read his book, and of course I already knew some of that from taking, you know, the Age of Jackson history, it wasn't until I was writing this new book and I got to the chapter I call Yellow Peril, of the Chinese immigration and the history behind it, that I found that obsession with China goes back to the Middle Ages. that it's a trend in Western history of the paranoia about China. It explains so much about, you know, this China bashing today, and the Wuhan flu, and, you know, this and that. They called it Yellow Peril, the Austrian Archduke or whatever he was, the leader of Austria, had a dream, you know, that the Chinese took over, and he called it the Yellow Peril, but it existed long before that. And then I realized that Europe, Western Europe, is not a continent. It's actually a peninsula of Asia. And they, you know, their imperialism, which was bred there with the Crusades, is, you know, it's a kind of internalized self-defense, you know, like of having to kill first. Even though, you know, China has never invaded Europe, has never really even threatened anyone in the West. There are no Chinese warships on our coasts or in the Caribbean. And the U.S. warships are all over the South China Sea. You know, it's, and this is so accepted by the general public, you know, that we're under threat by China all the time. So it gave me a deeper understanding than I had before about, I knew they wanted to get to the Pacific. And of course, then they went, you know, and annexed the Philippines and almost every island in the Pacific for bases. And it is an empire basis, and that's really important. David Vine, I don't know if you've read David Vine's work. He has a new book out.
Yes, I have. It's excellent.
Yeah, he's really, really good in understanding these 700-800 bases that the United States has. So it's unique in that sense of being an empire basis that has avoided having to, you know, after the Philippines, of actually a permanent, you know, having colonies to deal with. So they overlap colonialism and imperialism, but they're not, you know, they're not always, there's always imperialism, but not always colonies as such. Although there are people on those islands, of course, that in Guam, I mean, there are the Chamorro people that, the indigenous people who are very oppressed by it. So it is, you know, a form of colonialism as well. But I think that, I don't know if you all have looked into it, how much in the military subconscious you might detect that fear of China and the Chinese hordes and, you know, the Yellow Peril. Have you detected that all in your military experience?
Well, I'll just open with absolutely, and in fact, if you haven't read it, I'll shoot you an article. Andy Basevich wrote a pretty good piece, you know, West Point grad, big time anti-war guy now, who runs Quincy Institute, who's president over there. He wrote a piece based on the Army wrote this document, published it this year, basically all about finding a role sort of for the Army in this Pacific new Cold War, because that's always been sort of an Air Force and Navy dominated theater, at least since the Korean War. And what he detects in reading this document is that not only is there this alarmism about, you know, like a new Yellow Peril of sorts, but that each of the branches, each of the service branches of the military is like looking for a role, because from a parochial standpoint of the different branches of the service, everybody wants in on this like future conflict in order to like protect their budgets and their relevancy. But I have definitely noticed that there is a culture, like an assumption, that
China is an implacable foe, and that we will have to do something about China, and that it will be a military something. The question is at what level and how far it goes. But it reminds me of when I first went into the Army, and BT and Henry, you jump in at when I'm done here. I'm telling you if you had the same thing. But when I first came into the Army in 2001, in July, in basic training, so before September 11th, you know, and for years after that, we were still shooting targets with red stars on their helmets, and they were called Crazy Ivans. And back then, even though the Cold War had been over for 10 years, the lingering effects of it were that in the military culture, in the Army culture as I saw it, the assumption was still that, like, the Russians, the Ruskies were the enemies. And what's interesting is there was always a Chinese component to that, because they were always like a subset of the Cold War, like a second theater, but like not quite as important. But I'm starting to see even more of an assumption that it is in fact China that's the real threat, that we spend so much time worrying about Russia, and yeah, we're still worried about Putin and all that with the Trump and the elections, but real power is China. That's the future enemy, and there's an assumption that there's a military solution. I don't know, guys, what did you think about that in your time in the service regarding China and Russia and such?
One of the first ranges I did after I got to Fort Lewis following basic training, I was getting ready to shoot the Mark 19, which is a grenade machine gun, essentially. It shoots grenades very fast if you can get it to keep shooting. But my platoon sergeant was just kind of encouraging people as they were up on the line, and I remember him screaming out, "Kill a commie for mommy!" And I was like, at first I didn't understand what the hell he was talking about, and then I thought about it for a while, and it's like, okay. But this was 2003. So, yeah, that stuff lingers an awful long time.
Yeah, 2005, 2006, we were still heavily into the Russian invasion problem, you know, seeing the Crazy Ivans, and all of our tactics are still being based off of fighting the Cold War, as opposed to, you know, we're several years into fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan now, and we still haven't changed our tactics and our doctrines yet. It wasn't really the only real training that we got for Iraq and Afghanistan was from all the reclass people who had gone through before. We had a lot of air defense artillery guys who had gone overseas to Iraq and Afghanistan, and they realized that, you know, they were being sent out as infantry anyway, so they might as well get all the combat training, either infantry or scouts.
You know, I think Russia is also, I remember, you know, doing a lot of work at human rights over at in Geneva. There's a kind of permanent presence of some really interesting people who head the non-governmental organizations and the UN organizations. And there are really a lot of smart people who I've learned a lot about the world from. But Edith Ballantyne, who was certainly a mentor. She's the Secretary General of the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. And she said one day, she herself was an immigrant to Canada, a refugee. Her family were refugees from Czechoslovakia, German-speaking Bohemia, who had been communists. And were some of them had been in concentration camps. And anyway, her family was in Canada, so she had her own life experience. But she said there's a kind of racism against Russians. And she didn't put it in those terms, but I thought of that when I was doing this chapter on the Yellow Peril, that it extends beyond China. China is the center of it, but it really expands to Slavs, you know, to that this kind of then to Orientalism, what Edward Said so brilliantly theorized of the Western view, the Arabs and Muslims. So it extends beyond China, that the Yellow Peril. I included all of Asia under that moniker, you know, just because there is that specific kind of racism that these people are inherently a threat. Somehow they're out to get us. And of course, 9/11, you know, that was like a dream come true for paranoia about the coming to get. And boy, did they ever strike back, huh? You guys got the brunt of it too. But that, you know, that is so scary for the pretty immediate future of war. Even though I don't think China will ever be the aggressor in that sense. I mean, you know, come and invade the United States or Russia either, but they certainly have, you know, they have the weaponry to fight back and nuclear weaponry. And so I think it's really, plus the SpaceX thing, you know, what are they calling it? That new command? Space Command?
Space Force. And we thought Star Wars was a joke in the 80s, right?
Right.
It's like Reagan is like, see, I'm vindicated from the grave. That's what he's thinking.
Really? He would be celebrating. Yeah. So there's, you know, really some, if we don't, I know, Danny, you're a historian too, but, and you probably get as frustrated as I do of people not wanting to deal with history, saying, well, this is the present, this is what we have to deal with. And I just don't see how we can deal with any of these things without coming to terms with U.S. history. Because why has the left never won in the United States? Never won anything ever. You know, every other country in the world, you know, has left parties and our trade unions, our business, you know, business outfits, corporate, and even those are diminishing almost to zero. The private, you know, private for private companies, and the public workers are so unions are restricted about their strikes, and also we don't have, you know, the kinds of institutions that can put up a real fight, you know, and get through. To be a politician, you almost have to, even if you don't believe it, you have to accept the narrative of the United States. And so it just keeps ritually, you know, reproducing itself. I know a lot of teachers, I don't know what the effects will be, but the Indigenous people's history of the United States just really hit a chord with teachers and librarians. And they've made it, you know, a best-selling book, you know, and like in the top 1,000 books for the last 6 years. And I can't even fulfill all the invitations I get to go and talk with educators. The thing that most surprised me was last September, a year ago September, I was invited to the Teachers of the Northeast gathering, K to 12 teachers. And there's a young adult version of Indigenous People's History that came out in July of last year. So I was invited, and they had me as a keynote, and I didn't realize that every teacher there was going to, in the fall, use that book. There were like 3,000 or so teachers there. It just really blew my mind that this is what they're teaching to young people. And I don't know what the effect will be. I don't even know how they keep their jobs teaching this book. But, you know, they teachers are pretty remarkable. So it's they seem to be the only ones with, you know, dynamic unions as well, teachers and nurses. So I think we have to, and I think you guys and, you know, the and women, the people who've been in the military, we're just, you know, we're kept innocent of anything that goes on in the military. We don't want to hear it, and they don't want us to hear it. And, you know, something like Fort Hood blows up, and maybe it's in the paper for 1 or 2 days, but it doesn't get to, you know, the reality. So I think the, for I've long felt this ever since the Vietnam War and the Vietnam Vets Against the War began, that this is the most important movement that that exists. And Veterans for Peace kept it going at a time when, you know, the wars were almost all covert in the 1980s. And, I mean, they were known. There was nothing secret, actually, about them. I mean, if I could find out, I don't know why the New York Times couldn't. It's like, I'm not an investigative reporter or have access to secrets, but they were covert. In other words, there weren't any or very few U.S. Citizens dying. So maybe you could talk about how you all are doing and what prospects you have for, you know, putting forth a really strong, I mean, really organizing yourself and seeing yourselves as, you know, if you will, the tip of the spear for our future.
Well, I'm going to start and finish kind of, and then turn over most of the rest of the conversation to Henry and BT, because you mentioned Veterans for Peace. As one of the organizations that maintained itself after Vietnam Veterans Against the War during kind of the dormant years of the anti-war movement, which one could argue we're still in, although I think there's a rising tide, because I'll be doing a call here in just a bit with some leadership of Veterans for Peace. They've actually managed to get a hearing with some members of the Biden transition team, and I've been asked to, you know, be on that next week, probably around the time this episode releases, actually, for the listeners. And we have a prep call on it. I think it is important to note that there's a lot of talk today, and some of it makes sense and some of it's overblown. But I think we've all heard a lot of talk about, you know, okay, boomer, you know, this idea of sort of almost like dismissing like an entire generation as kind of like foggy and sort of out of touch and politically, you know, awful and bigoted. And in many cases, that's true. But what's wrong about it is that there's two things. Number one, it misunderstands the real gains, however small, okay, but the real street activism gains of a generation that was empowered during the civil rights and anti-Vietnam War movement that we should take seriously, because we haven't ended any wars. You know, not that that was the main or the only factor that ended the Vietnam War, but there was serious work done. So I think we shouldn't dismiss the activism of the previous generation, but also, you know, there were folks who kept it going, who never quit. They didn't stop when the draft ended. And they weren't just veterans, but Veterans for Peace was an organization that really kind of like rekindles itself in the 80s after Vietnam Veterans Against the War kind of dies out. And as you mentioned, they're at the forefront of fighting against the proxy wars of the Reagan years in particular, in Central America, in anti-apartheid international activism, which was very much tied to the apartheid here at home, as well as Israel, or it should be. And it was really inspiring. And my last point that's interesting about veterans and their potential to be not a vanguard exactly, but a part, an important part, especially in a society that adulates them so, right? You know, whether that's good or bad, I think it's a fetishization and it's awful, but living in the world as it is, I think we have to use that platform we've been given. But sometimes the veterans that speak like weren't even necessarily veterans of the U.S. Army. And to that, I mean, you know, I rewatched the old documentary from the 80s, The Good War or The Good Fight, which was about the veterans of the Lincoln Brigade, American volunteers in the Spanish-American War, the original Antifa, right? And we were supposed to say Antifa is bad now, right? But these guys who went and fought against fascism and Franco when our government was kind of complicit with him. And of course, Texaco selling him all the oil he needed because the Germans and Italians couldn't give him that because they were importers themselves. But these thousands of guys who go over there and they take 70% casualties in their first battle, which is actually the highest rate for a U.S. Army unit, except they weren't even a U.S. Army unit in the history of our wars. And they were rallying with Veterans for Peace. There's a clip in this documentary, which is actually pretty much worth watching. I mean, it's older, but it's very good. There's a clip in the 80s where veterans of the Lincoln Brigades, you know, these are lefties, right? These are old school lefties in the United States. Many of them Communist Party members, many of them union members, a third of them Jewish, about half of them from the New York area, most of whom had never fired a firearm. They got to fire five bullets before the battle at Jarama, right, which is memorialized in Woody Guthrie's song and stuff, Jarama Valley. But they actually, in the cattle cars that brought them to the battle, they got five bullets that day, and they fired them at a barn. They got to test fire five bullets. First time most of them had ever fired a gun. These are city kids. These are New York kids. And they're massacred, of course, but they fight very bravely. They were rallying with the Veterans for Peace in solidarity against our support for the Contras, against our support for the military dictatorship in El Salvador that was murdering priests and nuns. And it was an inspiring thing. And to watch it, to remember that that happened, and it does tell me that there is a role for veteran organizations to use the credibility they have to continue that activism. And if the Biden administration goes Obama style again, sort of where it's abstract, tech heavy, drones, advisors, and doesn't do the big invasions like of Iraq, which I suspect is probably what's going to happen. We're going to need to be out in the forefront saying, look, no, this is really war. It feels like war to the Yemeni children under the American made bombs. Just because we're not invading with hundreds of thousands of troops doesn't mean we're not at war. And they're going to have to help fire up an anti-war movement. So that's my basic take on it. Fellas, you jump in and I'm probably going to dip off here in a bit. And I know you have so much more to ask about the books and specifically some of the Native American stuff with BT.
The guys and I love doing the podcast. Being able to share our experiences in the military with allies and supporters means the world to us. But we can't do all the work. We need you to share an episode of ours with someone, anyone whom you might think would be affected by it. Young people looking to join the military or parents advocating for one, conscientious citizens who care about the violence the U.S. wages in their name, advocates for women and people of color who understand the harsh environment the military creates for minorities and inflicts on minorities across the globe, and anyone else you think it might affect, please take a moment and share this with them. Our podcast is supported in a few different ways. First, there's Patreon, where we're blessed to have an array of wonderful supporters helping the guys and I pay for some of the podcast's expenses. Those who contribute $10 a month or more will be mentioned right here as an honorary producer, helping keep you, our listeners, stocked with new episodes. But you don't have to contribute $10 a month to help us. For as little as $1 a month, you can help keep us going, paying for hosting and storage fees, transcribing old and new episodes, promoting and expanding the podcast, and more I'm sure I can't think of at the moment. So let's bring out our honorary producers, and they are Will Arenz, Fahim Shirazi, James O'Barr, Adam Bellows, Eric Phillips, Paul Appel, Julie Dupree, Thomas Benson, Emma P., Janet Hansen, Tristan Oliver, Daniel Fleming, Michael Karen, Jason, Zach H., Ren, Jacob, and the Status Quo podcast. Your contributions are wonderfully helpful to us. Thank you so much. However, if Patreon isn't your style, you can contribute directly to us through PayPal at paypal.me/fortressonahill. Or please check out our awesome store on spreadshirt.com for some great Fortress merch. The link is in the show notes. And now, let's get back to the podcast.
Thanks, Danny. Happy New Year.
Oh, yes. I can't wait for a new year. 2020 has been rough.
Roxanne, I'm floored hearing what you mentioned about so many teachers and libraries using your work. I think that's just incredible. And somewhat connected to our discussion here about veterans, that there's I know for me, learning some U.S. imperial history and moving into that very wide subject, there was a feeling of betrayal of why did I not know about this much earlier in my life. And I mean, it's stereotypical, you know, history instruction for, you know, going to public school in America. It's useless. It's if there is something mentioned about U.S. being an imperial state, it's limited to what you and Danny were talking about earlier as being a blip on the radar and not what we have going. But I think that sense of betrayal, you know, for veterans like BT Danny and myself, finding out that there was all of this knowledge and history and our quote unquote service, if you want to call it that, was marching over that. And, you know, I know I feel a sense of betrayal on that. So, you know, for people, for instructors and professors and librarians who I would imagine consider themselves first, you know, they consider themselves to know a lot of things, to hear this history and to know that it needs to be added in the history they already have could be a great betrayal in their minds. And I can definitely understand that viewpoint.
Yeah, I agree. I think we do have, I mean, we know from these demonstrations in June, that and you know, some of that Black Lives Matter was born here right in the Bay Area where I live, and I saw it developing, and it really we have to keep that in mind, that it started, you know, just with three women and a hashtag talking to each other, not knowing what to do about these horrible incidents that were happening. You know, our incident here and with the Bart killing a young man. This is, it feels so helpless, you know, so they developed it into an amazing movement that burst out in June that was unexpected. I think even they had no idea that it would become, you know, what it did. So we never know, you know, what our efforts will produce, but we know that nothing will happen if we don't keep doing, you know, something that then does, you know, does have the possibility to take off. And I sometimes feel, of course, I'm, you know, I'm older now and I'm limited in physically and what I can sustain. I wasn't able to go out to the demonstrations. I'm an asthmatic, you know, I'm prone to any flu that comes around. And probably would die, you know, if I contracted this disease. So I gained confidence in writing the book, that because of the other book having made such an impact, that so many different endeavors, you know, make a difference. It doesn't have to be any one thing, but I do think we need organization. And I in the past, changes, real changes, revolutions have relied upon working class, you know, the working class as a working class, as a conscious working class. And we don't seem to have that in the United States, but actually we do. I mean, teachers and nurses are a good part of the working class. And of course, health workers, as the people age and as we suffer these pandemics and all, are probably going to be one of the largest sectors of the working class. And we define the working class as, you know, people working on the production line or in the mines, you know, digging metals out of the mines or the coal mines. And it's a very masculinized concept of the working class. Teachers and health workers are, you know, predominantly women. So I was thinking that, but I was thinking on the other hand that the, you know, military veterans have learned a discipline and, you know, some very useful human traits that are given to organizing. So I think that that's really important. BT, do you live in California, BT?
I used to live in California. I live in Nevada right now.
Oh, you're in Nevada. Yeah. And Henry, you're up in Salem.
Portland.
I mean, Portland. Yeah. Right. But you were at Fort Lewis. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I spent 6 years at Fort Lewis.
I met a wonderful Iraq vet against the war who had a little bitty office there outside of Fort Lewis. I lost touch with him, but there was some pretty interesting things going on there. Didn't you have one officer who did something? What was it? What happened at Fort Lewis?
There was a, towards the very beginning of the Iraq War, there was a lieutenant, a first lieutenant, if I remember correctly, who refused to deploy.
That's right.
I can't remember his name at the moment, but I'll look it up and add it to the show notes. But and he was seen as a pariah in the ranks. I remember hearing people talk about him back then that it was just, you know, how dare he step away from his duty but you know, looking back on it now, is that those are the examples that we need to follow. But Roxanne, I'd like to chat a little bit about your new book. Title of Not a Nation of Immigrants. I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about its, you know, its main thrusts and your reason for writing it.
Yeah, I think it was when, you know, I wrote a little I call it, it's really like a rant more than an essay, but it got in 2005, I think. I did it on Monthly Review's online blog that they had started, and it traveled to others, and then it got all over social media. Facebook didn't exist yet, but it got revived when Facebook existed. Counterpunch posted it, and it started traveling again. It was called Stop Calling This a Nation of Immigrants. And it's basically an argument about settler colonialism that, you know, people like to say that they were early immigrants or before the revolution, they immigrated, they were first immigrants. And So it's a way of covering up settler colonialism. But on the other hand, there have been, you know, after settler colonialism was completely set institutionally, then you had the influx, the first influx of a massive influx of Irish famine refugees in the 1840s. There were no immigration laws other than the alien and sedition laws, you know, of Alexander Hamilton's work. But aliens, you know, who are spying and all, but there were no immigration laws. And so they just came, you know, anyone who wanted to come to the United States just came on a boat and got off, and there they were. It was a different, you know, to become a citizen, they had to do a few things, but not very much. But these were all Europeans, and of course the Irish were white and mostly fair. And they were terribly persecuted. You know, I've always heard a lot of stories about the difficulties they had. It was right when the U.S. invasion of Mexico was being prepared, and they were swooped up, as immigrants tended to be, you know, like at the waterfront, these army catchers just swooping them up and putting them into the army to go fight. And of course, some of them, a whole battalion, they formed a battalion and changed sides and fought on the side of Mexico in that war, the Patricio Brigade. But most of the Irish, I mean, the bulk of them did not do that, and many were killed. And so they were, you know, they were horribly treated. But I started looking at, you know, what I was interested in is this nation of immigrants. First of all, just that concept. And then, you know, that was like 2005. And then 10 years later, 2015, this blockbuster Broadway movie came out, Hamilton, The Revolution, which totally falsifies everything in it. Practically is false, including all of the founders being black people, dark people, and no slaves in the whole thing. But beyond that, you know, it was its main theme, and what people went crazy for, especially liberals, was that, because liberals used to hate Hamilton, and conservatives liked him because he was a diehard capitalist. But suddenly, because he's portrayed as an immigrant, and I thought it's kind of tragic that a Puerto Rican who's colonized, you know, a place that's colonized, Lin-Manuel Miranda, would be the one to, you know, proclaim himself as an immigrant to New York when he was, you know, a U.S. citizen forced upon him because he was colonized in Puerto Rico. So twisting that history and then seeing Hamilton as a Caribbean who came as a poor shoeless immigrant. And of course, none of that was true. He was white and he was of the elite and he was British and he came before the revolution and he was a settler. You know, he came to go to Columbia University and he was an elite. And he was not an immigrant. I mean, no one was called an immigrant before the revolution. They were settlers. So, and they were all European, except the slaves who were brought from Africa. So that falsification and that renewal of a nation of immigrants. So when I started, you know, my editor of Indigenous People's History of the United States at Beacon Press, I have one paragraph in that book, Indigenous People's History, I don't know if you remember that, if you read it, if you remember that paragraph, but it's just one paragraph where I denounce the Nation of Immigrants context. It's in the context of saying what settler colonialism is and how that tries to cover it up. And she asked me if I could write a book on that. And I said, sure, I'll write a book on that too. But about that, that was, you know, that was only 3 years ago. But what I was really had gotten upset about was the Hamilton musical. And I did go see it because I felt like I couldn't write it, you know, without write about it without seeing it. And I found, you know, fellow travelers, Ishmael Reed, who's a Black poet and writer in Oakland, wrote a one-act play, who the real Alexander Hamilton was. But I, you know, I then started doing research on where did this come from, you know, this Nation of Immigrants. And it wasn't hard to find out that it was John F. Kennedy, which is interesting, a son of Irish immigrants, rich ones, but nevertheless Irish. And he wrote it when he was a senator, 1958. And it looks like it was a preparation for running for president, how to naturalize immigration by making everyone an immigrant. Because I realized once I started doing the book and researching that it wasn't at all. And I knew from my own life experience growing up in rural Oklahoma, there were those of us who were settlers. We were original Americans. My father was Scots-Irish heritage before the Revolution. They started coming in the 17th century, and then there were the immigrants. There were the Polish immigrants and the German immigrants, and by the time I was growing up, they were already they were first and second generation U.S. citizens. They were no longer, you know, from the old country. I remember one family, very elderly, who was from the old country still, but they were, we still call them immigrants. You know, they're the immigrants and we're the settlers, you know? So I knew that, but I had never really put it together how people get Americanized, you know, and how in some ways immigrants, of course, immigrants of color never do really, even enslaved Africans, descendants who came before most white people in the United States. They can date themselves back to, you know, 1619. They're never quite full citizens. They're contingent. They're contingent people, and only these original white settlers, Scots, Irish, or English, or German, were acceptable as the true. And I think we see that with white nationalism, that, you know, 90% of these people are descendants of old settlers today, you know. So I realized that it was a fairly recent invention, the idea of a Nation of Immigrants, and it did originate with John F. Kennedy. And it took off because it got published and it was a bestseller because he was already famous. You know, he was already a celebrity when he was a senator. And then he became president. So, and he instigated the 1964. He was dead when it was actually signed by Johnson, but he's the one that negotiated and put through the legislation for the 1964 Immigration Act that opened immigration to non-Europeans because it had been clamped down in 1924. They put a stop because of Chinese immigration. They had barred Chinese immigration already in the 1880s. And then the Eastern Europeans and Italians who came when there were no immigration laws against them, you know, immigrating only against the Chinese. These were Catholics and Jews mostly. And it was a very troubled time for the Anglo-Saxon state and Theodore Roosevelt and others that saw them as lesser humans and dark, especially the Italians, you know, dark. So this Americanization process that took place, but they also cut off that immigration. No more immigration except Western Europe was allowed. So that, you know, so Kennedy's book was really the source of A Nation of Immigrants, and it hadn't really been something that was popular, you know, that everyone said, everyone's an immigrant. Of course, it wipes out indigenous people entirely to say everyone's an immigrant. And the way Kennedy handles it in the book is very interesting because he says he does mention that this one group could be said not to be immigrants, and that's the Native Americans. And then he gives this white nationalist theory that actually kind of developed in Ireland, but it has other sources too. It's a whole thing I go through in the book of U.S., you know, immigrants wanting to indigenize themselves one way or another. So it's a story it's an idea that that the present Native Americans in North America were the invaders who came from God knows where, probably Asia, from China. That's the Bering Straits theory. And they come and they wipe out the Aboriginal people and who may have come from Ireland. Yeah, so he actually makes himself an original settler who was killed by the Indians, his ancestors. This all sounds crazy, but it's, you know, it's really... it really is, you know, the whole history of immigration is so fraught with oppression of peoples and then putting them through the meat grinder of Americanization, Americanizing them. So, and part of that one requirement up until probably, you know, the civil rights movement, it has waned, expressing anti-Black racism as a way of proclaiming your whiteness. James Baldwin wrote about that a lot, you know, in the 1960s, that here's someone just off the boat, can't speak a word of English, has no education, and looks at me and, you know, 5 days later says I'm supposed to go to work for him. You know, that I mean, it's an exaggeration, but, you know, that was an experience of a Black people, that the immigrant was someone who had to become, and of course the Irish become virulently anti-Black, and also become the policeman. This was one of the most interesting things in the book. I was very interested in pursuing, you know, the research on Irish immigration and getting to, you know, how it was. I posted on Facebook a question about Irish immigration, and that I was writing a chapter, and about, God knows, I haven't gone back to look for a while, but last time I looked, it was like 4,000 or 5,000 people had posted on there with their ideas. I think I only read about the first 1,000. I gave up because I did discover two wonderful Irish historians who were so helpful in guiding me, Irish American historians who were helpful in guiding me to literature. And but one thing stood out. The question I posed was, how did the Irish become white? You know, that there's a book called that by Noel Ignatieff. And this one person who didn't identify herself as Black, but I expect she was, because she wrote, "When they became the police." And I thought, well, how did this happen? You know, what was the process? And what happened is they formed gangs in the cities, in Boston and New York and Philadelphia, as immigrants had to do, you know, in order to survive. They formed gangs. They still do. You know, our main drug dealers in the Bay Area is a Honduran gang, you know. So this is, you know, immigrants have to find a way to survive. So basically the police, and there was a, you know, the DiCaprio movie, Gangs of New York, that goes through some of this history. But the police are fighting them, but the police are not really formed as police forces when the Irish refugees come in. So in the 1870s, the Irish start becoming police. And then because they have kinship relations with other Irish, because they have clans, they start bringing, you know, their clans, brothers and sisters and their familial relatives into the police forces. And the police forces actually form initially in the large eastern, northeastern cities as predominantly Irish. And to this day, most police unions are headed, you know, by Irish. They still have a lot of power in the police forces. They also took jobs as slave patrollers in the what became the Confederate states, you know, between their arrival in the 1840s and 1860. They worked as slave patrollers. They took whatever jobs they could. They worked in the mines. They worked on the canals, on the railroads. The eastern half of the railroads were mainly Irish, who had been Irish refugees, and Chinese on the West Coast. So that was, you know, those are some of the, and I already, you know, I talked about the Yellow Peril. So when I started the book, it was going to be a small book that was basically dealing, with the Constitution and with the immigration and the oppression. I knew I wanted to deal with the Irish refugees. But as I got into it, it opened up other things, and the book went from supposedly to be 60,000 words to 120,000. So it's actually a big book now. It wasn't really intended to be. It was going to be a kind of brief, but, you know, getting into just what really settler colonialism is. And that's still, you know, a theme throughout the book, but it grew to much more than that. So it was really interesting, because it was a very deep learning process for me as well. And I actually wrote the book in the last 6 months. I wrote it. I really sat down and began seriously writing the book. So in some ways, the isolation, having to isolate, gave me the opportunity to research and write every waking hour for the last 6 months, which was really a great gift under these circumstances. But that's a long answer to, you know, how the book came about and developed and sort of what it's about.
So just to kind of point us towards closing out here, I was curious about your thoughts on the Trump administration legacy as it pertains to certainly to imperialism, but specifically to immigration. And especially since you've spent the last 6 months talking about or writing about it, I'm very curious to hear your thoughts as we close out the Trump presidency.
Yeah, it was, he gave me an awful lot of material. you know, it's really interesting, this Americanization process, because here's a man who is the son of an immigrant from Scotland. His mother came from Scotland as an immigrant, and is a first generation German. His grandfather was from Germany, and he's such a white nationalist that immigrant means people of color, means basically Mexicans, Muslims. He makes it clear who he means. And you know, it was almost every day, of course, last year and 2018, especially the caravans coming to the border, that this lack of consciousness from one generation to the next, or even one presidency to the next, that those wars, the U.S. covert intervention in the civil wars and creation of a civil war in Nicaragua, and taking the side of the governments in El Salvador and Nicaragua and Honduras. El Salvador and Guatemala, military governments against movements to displace them, that this created chaos. The United States, once they won, and they did win, they drove the Sandinistas out, you know, in 1989 electorally, and in El Salvador and Guatemala, they didn't persist. You know, the revolutions did not continue. So they won and they got out and you know, never thought about it again. So here, 25 years later, it really started in, you know, around 2000 or so, it just wasn't that noticed. Here come, you know, masses of refugees from Central America. And then they staged another coup under Obama in 2009, just after he took office. I'm sure it had already been in the works. And had Clinton for Secretary of State. She had ties with the coup makers in Honduras. They overthrew, you know, a left populist, a very wealthy rancher in Honduras. But nevertheless, he decided to take a stand for the people, and was doing amazing things for a year or so, and 2 years, and then he was overthrown. So you have these Honduran, ever since then it's been a drug controlled, you know, cartel controlled country, and so you have these Honduran caravans coming to the border. So there's no consciousness in the U.S. public of why they're coming, you know, why they're starving, why they're sending their children, unaccompanied children, to safety from gangs, because the gangs start recruiting boys, especially when they're 9 and 10 years old, you know, grooming them. And why would parents do that unless they were desperate? So it was bad. I mean, it was bad the whole time under Obama. He was, you know, he's called a deporter in chief in Central America. He was deporting many more people. But Trump made it a popular cause, you know, of hating immigrants, and touched into that thread, you know, of white nationalism that hasn't raised its head since the 1920s, and the anti-Catholic Ku Klux Klan of you know, immigrants being the main target of. Well, there was quite a lot against the Vietnamese refugees back in the 1980s, especially in Texas, but not a huge, you know, national movement against immigration. So, yeah, Trump has set things back so much. I think that Biden, even in his most enlightened part of him, and there are parts of him that are enlightened, like the you know, environment and immigration, hopefully, although he was part of the Obama administration that was deporting. Certainly he won't have the same rhetoric, but to reverse all of the things that Trump has done, much of it by executive order, it's going to take him a good year. I don't see how he could possibly do everything as quickly, you know, as what has been done in 4 years. So there's so much damage that has been done, and so much damage in building that border wall to both the environment and to the people there, that it's really going to be a chore to undo. And then if Trump manages to get a war going with Iran in the next month or so, and if Biden has war on his hands, or near war, or the South China Sea, or whatever, it's really going to be difficult. And I think we're going to need a really strong movement to keep him on track, you know, to reverse these items. He's put in some pretty good people. I think Deb Haaland is an environmentalist, and he'll give her a pretty free hand with the you know, with the endangered species and the environmental controls on the Department of Transportation. They have, you know, the emissions controls. And so he's putting in pretty competent people. As far as the foreign policy goes, I'm not so confident that, you know, the Secretary of Defense and the Secretary of State are not, you know, they're clearly not pacifists or anti-war. So you guys are going to have that on your hands, you know, trying to make turn that policy, you know, away from intervention and war and assassinations of leaders, Iranian. That and drone attacks using the air as a way of targeted killing. So I guess our time is up. But if you have any one last thing you want me to talk about, let me know.
ABT, did you want to jump in with that one other thing you mentioned?
Yeah, I just wanted to say, you know, we've been talking about history and we've been talking about like language and how important it is. I think one of the things that struck out most to me in Indigenous People's Guide was the phrase "in country." Now, you know, I was in 2005 through 2014, and I used the phrase a lot. I know me and Chris were talking earlier, and he said that he used the phrase a lot, and I just had no idea that "in country" was short for Indian country, and that one really struck a chord with me.
Yeah, that was, you know, it got revived during the invasion of Iraq, the Indian country, but in the Gulf War was when I first started really noticing it, that it was Indian country. They weren't even saying "in country." They were saying "Indian country." Indian country this. And newscasters were saying it. And I wrote an essay about it at the time, that it was just really, I was a visiting professor at Miami University in Ohio, not in Florida, but in Ohio, right where Tecumseh, you know, that first big defeat in the old Northwest of the Native people in that fight, the Pawan Timbers. And it was resonated so much because everything there is dated 1808, you know, and celebrating that genocide. And that was Indian country. That's the source of the word, is that old Northwest, the Ohio country that is written into the Northwest Ordinance to conquer. And that was where the U.S. Army really got formed. And it was resonating because they were using that as a, because there hadn't been, you know, these big wars with regiments since the Vietnam War. They'd all had been covert, except the very quick invasion of Grenada and the quick invasion of Panama in 1989. This was the first big war, you know, 500,000 troops. And the country was ecstatic. When I was driving back to Ohio, while the, you know, after the fighting broke out, I was driving back to, you know, serve in that visiting capacity there that winter. And everywhere I drove, you know, there were these huge yellow ribbons draped around posts and trees and candles and windows all through, you know, I-40. I actually went down even lower the border to miss the snow along the Mexican border into those Texas cities. And I felt like if I had had a bumper sticker that said the U.S. out of Iraq, that my car, you know, if I were in it, I'd probably be killed. My car would be burned or wrecked or all the windows broken. That's how much violence I felt. And it was really terrifying to see that come back, you know, that, and it's never really left since then, you know. It revived again, you know, with the Iraq War, invasion of Iraq. But there was far more opposition to it. The Gulf War, there was hardly any opposition. It was pretty depressing, and none about Grenada or Panama. So this is, you know, where it is today. You know, the Indian country is sort of just still in the minds of people when they think of enemy territory. It's Indian country. And of course, in Vietnam, it had been. It was also everywhere. And There's a really good book that you all might want to read that's kind of, I think it's still in print, by Tom Hayden, who was a peace activist, you know, leader back in the Vietnam War. He went to Vietnam several times and brought back POWs. And it's called, I can't think of the title, but it's, it's a quote from Sitting Bull, and I can't think of it. But look up Tom Hayden's work and find that. It tells about all of the, it was published like in 1972, 73. And I didn't know at the time, I had never heard about, you know, Indian country being a military term. And I read that book, and it's like all of the terms. It's like, when it's time for them to plant corn, and, you know, of course it was rice they're talking about, but they used the terminology of Indian country for everything. And then I started teaching at Cal State University in Hayward. And Vietnam, had a lot of Vietnam veterans coming back and enrolling. We had the Alameda base, and Marines especially were in my classes. And I was teaching Native American studies and also U.S. history. And they would, you know, by then I knew about Indian country. And I would bring it, you know, I would mention it, and they would always comment that they had no idea what, when they used that term, they had no idea that it had anything to do with Native Americans, you know, and Indian Wars, that it was just a term, and how unconscious that is, you know, how it's built into us. I think that's what it says. But the in country is still used by journalists. I hear them all the time on CNN, you know, not just Fox News, but CNN and all the in country. I wonder, was it used that much when you were serving?
Oh yes, it was used a lot. I don't recall ever hearing it as Indian country, but I heard and used in country my entire time in the Army, and because of, you know, I thought it was actually a military term of some kind, that it was, you know, we're in country, like we're on deployment, you know, and I didn't, because of that shortened version, I didn't connect it to Native Americans at all.
Yeah.
But you also mentioned in Indigenous Peoples about how that the mission to kill Osama bin Laden was named Geronimo, how we have, you know, 7 or 8 helicopter variations that are all named after tribes or people, that there's no genuine modicum of respect for Native American culture. And I don't know how I didn't see that more when I was still in, but now I can't not see it.
Yeah. Well, the ball teams, you know, I don't know if you noticed that the Cleveland Indians are finally dropping.
I did. They're finally going to change it.
Yeah. And Trump was outraged. You know, he twittered, you know, weaklings, Cleveland, don't give in to cancel culture. He's now using that term. Yeah. So, and of course, the Washington team, that was, they haven't yet dropped it, but next year they claim they're going to. So, but there are something like, I just saw it on Facebook, a young Native American had done this research, something like 8,000, I think he said 8,000, names of sport teams, you know, from junior high to the professional, that are named one way or another with Indian names or with Indian mascots. 8,000.
Yeah, the high school I graduated from was just the Indians, the Dalles High Indians.
Yeah. But that does get into people's subconsciousness, you know, and they don't know what it means. And I think that's why we have so much mental illness in the United States, that people have this, you know, this knowledge that they don't know what to do with. You know, it really all adds up to a kind of genocidal mentality that's unresolved, and they're not responsible for. You know, they didn't do it, but they're imbued with it without being able to explain it, and kind of haunted in that way. As we do have an extraordinary excess of, you know, there are studies of all over the world, people experience bipolar and autism and depression. These are, you know, like things that can go wrong with the brain. But beyond the normal, you know, percentage in any country, the United States is just far and away more disturbed, you know, that there's so much that's unspoken. And yet, you know, you're digesting all that stuff. It's like toxins and have the effect on the human body. So that's why I think, you know, truth telling is for good health.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's very common in veterans. You know, I know that I had many, I still have moments like that, but the, you know, relearning history and remembering the cultural connections for me that some of that pseudo history made. But it's like, you know, for modern veterans, talking about the truth is often akin to attacking their identity, you know, very much with, you mentioned in that lecture I listened to recently about the cult of the Constitution, that it goes so far beyond the actual meaning. You know, like you mentioned, most people in other countries that have constitutions have no personal connection to it. It's a constitution. It may work well, it may work poorly, but it's not something that they wrap around themselves, whereas Americans really do. And in the military, that's doubly so. So I could see, you know, the sentimental nature of people's service kind of creeping in and refusing to let them go. And that's a personal thing they have to deal with. But it brings me to James Baldwin's mention about sentimentality and what sentimentality does to people in terms of remembrance. We don't remember accurately or honestly, we remember emotionally. We react sentimentally. Roxanne, I want to thank you so much for coming and chatting with us today. Do you have a specific website where people can go if you have a blog posts or articles or excerpts from your book or anything?
I do. I don't keep it up as well as I should, but it's called Red Dirt Site, all lowercase reddirtsite .com. .com. reddirtsite.com.
Okay. That way I can add that to the show notes and people can know where to find your stuff.
At Beacon Press, you Google just my name and Beacon Press, they also have a site and they put up excerpts of my books. So they'll have an excerpt up soon for Nation of Immigrants.
Well, thank you again, Roxanne. It was wonderful to talk to you again, and I hope we will talk again soon.
Thank you, Henry. Thank you, BT. You take care of yourselves.
You too.
Bye, Roxanne.
Bye.
We're on Twitter at Fortress on a Hill and also at Facebook.com at Fortress on a Hill. You can find our main blog page and our full collection of episodes at www.fortressonahill.com. iTunes, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, Patreon, Spotify, you name it, almost anywhere you listen, we're already waiting for you. And hey, We're always in the market for more Patreon supporters. Please consider becoming a patron at patreon.com. And if you're not into giving us a monthly payment, think about giving us a couple bucks on PayPal. The link is in the show notes. Skepticism is one's best armor. Never forget it. We'll see you next time.
You good people, and listen to my song. I hope you'll pay attention. I will not